interviewing Dr. Jerome Zoffer, Dean of the Business School, University of Pittsburgh. It is January 22, 1993, and the interviewers are Mimi Bly and Judy Rubenstein. Welcome, Dean Zoffer. We're happy to see you this morning.
Thank you. Pleased to be here.
We're very interested in learning as much about you as possible, and maybe it's easy just to start from your very beginnings and tell us about your background, your parents, if there's anything interesting with, you know, where your grandparents came from, and just start literally at the beginning.
Well, my grandparents on one side of the family came from Austria, and on the other side of the family came from Lithuania. So I've been accused of being Litvak, to which I guess I have to plead guilty. My parents were William and Sarah Zoffer. They were Pittsburgh area natives, though my mother's family, my mother was born in Turtle Creek, and my mother's family spent a good deal of time in Beaver Falls and New Brighton, which are small towns around the Pittsburgh area.
What was your mother's name?
Sarah Leah Fisher was her full name.
Do you recall her date of birth?
Her date of birth was January 19th, 1904.
Mm-hmm.
And she passed away in 1980. My father's family was from Rochester, Pennsylvania, another small town, relatively small town outside of Pittsburgh. And he passed away in 1948. And he was born July 17th, 1902.
Mm-hmm. And his name was?
His name was William Zoffer, no middle name. And he was one of four brothers. My mother was one of two brothers and two sisters.
Mm-hmm. So their families came to the United States approximately in what year?
I'm not certain exactly when they came to the United States, but I think it was somewhere around the 1890s, about that time.
Do you have any idea why they came, or just adventuresome?
I have very little knowledge, actually, of what motivated them, but they were part of the wave of immigrants that came about that time from Europe, and actually, my grandparents on my father's side died in 1912 and 1914, which was long before I was born, so I never had a chance to talk to them or find out much about them. My grandfather died in 1936 when I was a child, my grandmother about 10 years later. But I never recall any discussions about what the reasons were they're emigrating to the United States.
Do you know why they went to the Rochester area, Beaver Falls area?
Don't know that either. Don't know why they came to Western Pennsylvania, and don't know why they went down there, except I think that there were opportunities, particularly in small business, for Jewish immigrants at that time, and many of them were in some of the smaller towns where there was not much of a Jewish population and there was not much of an industrial core or commercial core, and they found opportunities to build businesses. My grandfather had a shoe store, that's how he made his living, on my mother's side. And my father's family was quite splintered all over the country. I met some of them in the last 15 years. Some of them had become Lutherans, and so it was quite a reunion at the time.
Well, tell us about when you were born. And
well, I was born in the height of the Depression in 1930. I was born in Pittsburgh and West Penn Hospital. And I've been in Pittsburgh ever since. Though I spent a lot of time on the road and outside of Pittsburgh, my home has always been in Pittsburgh.
Your parents had moved to Pittsburgh by the time you were born?
My parents were already in Pittsburgh when they got married in 1926, I believe. Mm-hmm. By that time, my grandmother's family and my mother with them had moved to Pittsburgh on Margaretta Street in East Liberty. And my father's parents had died, and he had come to Pittsburgh also. So they were in Pittsburgh when they were married and lived here all of their lives, and I've lived here all of my life.
And what did your father do for a living?
My father was had a number of different occupations. He worked for one of the breweries at one time. He was a musician, and he, in fact, he was a musician until very late in his life. He, at one time, had an orchestra called Billy Zoffer's Symphony Kings, and for years, even after he entered his final occupation, which was the insurance business, he would play on weekends and other times as a saxophonist and a vibraphonist, and he also played trumpet, but primarily saxophone, trombone, and vibraphone. And he made his living at one time by that, but that didn't prove to be a very good living, so he eventually got into the insurance business and established an insurance agency, which is what he was doing at the time of his death.
Mm-hmm. And were you the oldest?
I was the oldest. I'm one of two brothers. My brother's about 9 years, something like that, younger than I am. And we were the only two children.
And your brother's name is?
My brother's name is Joseph Zoffer. And he's an attorney, lives in Mount Lebanon. Has been a Pittsburgher all of his life also.
Will you describe to us some of your early years growing up? It obviously was in the East End.
I grew up in East End. I grew up on Hayes Street in East End, and I went to Fulton Elementary School and Peabody High School before I entered the University of Pittsburgh. We were family in very modest means, always struggling to meet the demands upon us during that period. My mother was not a career woman. She stayed home and took care of the children. I had a very pleasant childhood, which was relatively uneventful. I was active in organizations like AZA and similar organizations, but I don't think that there was a particular set of exciting events around my childhood that was either traumatic or compelling or revealing. It was a very traditional childhood, a four-person family, typical American four-person family with two children. Managed to go each year to the East Coast for vacation for 2 weeks. We would drive to see my father's brother and his family, who were in Pleasantville, which is about 5 miles from Atlantic City. So we spent about 2 weeks each year in the Atlantic Coast. And my early memories are of the beaches at Atlantic City, long before the casinos were there, when it was a resort town. And where there was a set of very good restaurants and lots of mosquitoes and a family reunion with my father's brother, and often other brothers came at the same time. So the highlight of the year were the 2 weeks we spent in Atlantic City, which shows what an uneventful, unexciting a time it really was. It was a quiet period. We were just in the United States coming out of the recession for the first 10 years of my life or so. We were sort of coming out of that recession, so most of the issues were economic ones, and the opportunity to drive over the mountains, over Route 30 for an ungodly number of hours, 12 hours or something, to get from Pittsburgh to Atlantic City was really the highlight of the year.
And what years about were you speaking?
Well, that was probably in the years from about 1934 or so until 1945, something like that. It was a ritual, just like some people went to the mountains for their vacations. We went to Atlantic City. The in-between times are...
Excuse me. So that was on Route 30. It took about 12 hours from Pittsburgh to Atlantic City. This was before the Dream Highway.
Before
the Pennsylvania Turnpike.
That's right. We used to go up the mountains and down the mountains, and the car would steam up, and we'd have to stop and let it cool down. And obviously, money was a big factor, so we packed large bags of sandwiches and stopped constantly by the roadside to eat and drink. And the pain of getting there was very high, because the car was always in relatively poor condition to meet the challenges of those high mountains, and the time for young children who always want to know when are we going to get there was a difficult factor. But we always did get there, and we always enjoyed it. And as I say, the lifestyle outside of that period was very quiet and really not very memorable. I certainly didn't grow up with a lot of childhood traumas, or the period of time was a time when the East End area was a residential area of great repute, great safety, very fine educational facilities. Greatest memories of childhood were of certain teachers who were either very good or very bad, or very idiosyncratic, or very helpful or very unhelpful.
Did any stand out especially?
Oh yes, to this day, which is more years later than I'm willing to admit, the several teachers, one at Fulton, whose name I haven't thought of in many years, whose name was Miss Naughton, who was the eighth grade mathematics teacher, and she was as stern a teacher and as good a teacher as I've ever had. If I had any knowledge of mathematics, it was because she drummed it into me. There was a Helen Main, who was a history teacher at Fulton School. She came and replaced a teacher whom the student body was abusing, is the only word I can use for it. They'd taken control of the class, so they brought in a disciplinarian. I remember it because I wrote it's my first entry into poetry writing. I wrote a 20-stanza poem expressing my emotions as this new teacher who came in and took all of the books out of our desks and threw them in the corner before we came in as an entry into her class and to show her authority. And this poem is an evolution of the terror we felt until the time when I really got to like her very much and appreciated her qualities as a teacher. And it's a sort of an evolution of my own thinking about education how a chaotic situation was turned into a highly disciplined one in a fine learning experience. Went on to high school at Peabody High School, which was a fine, fine high school at that time. I was fortunate enough to be in the accelerated program, academic program, which brought me into contact with some marvelous people who were part of the core of my own development. And as far as teachers there, My homeroom teacher, who eventually became my English teacher, was another hard disciplinarian, and her name was Adelaide Breckenridge. I have no idea why I'm able to remember these things. I can't remember what happened yesterday, and here I am drawing out the names of teachers who whose names haven't been in my mind for many years. Again, a strong disciplinarian, but a love of teaching, and I can still remember some of the things we talked about and her method of teaching. And to a certain extent, a lot of that influenced my eventual interest in becoming a teacher and in making the contribution that way. Though, as it turned out, that's not how I eventually made whatever contribution I made, but it is what intrigued me into the academic.
Were you well disciplined at home as well, or
no?
That was sounded a little easier.
I would say that it was a very easygoing environment at home. If there was any disciplining, it was because of the fighting that my brother and I did with one another. But in a sense, during those days, discipline wasn't very necessary.
This is session number 3 with Dean Jerry Zoffer at the Katz School of Business. Mimi Bly and Judy Rubenstein interviewing on April 29th, 1993. I think we'd like to begin this session with your personal life, if we could. We didn't really hear much about your courtship and marriage and children, so I think that might be a nice place to begin.
Well, do you want to ask questions, or do you just want me to ramble on?
Why don't you start?
Okay. Well, let's see. My courtship was an extremely brief one. I met my wife on a blind date, and which was arranged by a sorority sister of hers, who at that time was dating a close friend of mine. And I was, as they say, between partners at the time, and with a certain amount of reluctance, I allowed this arrangement to happen. And then later discovered that one of my colleagues at Pitt, who was working with me, had my what turned out to be my wife in a class, and he independently had picked her out as someone who he thought I should meet. So it turned out that forces were operating from two different directions.
You didn't have a chance.
The two of us together. And I had no chance whatsoever, I guess, under those circumstances. So we went out one cold winter evening and in January, and we had a really good time. And when we came back, I took my date for the evening to the door, and it was really freezing out there, and I sort of wished that she would invite me in while we said goodnight because it was so cold. But I didn't get that invitation. She was demure and proper on first dates, and so I was left sort of hanging outside the screen door while we said goodbye. And when I went back to the car where my friend was driving, he said, "How was it?" And I said, "Well, I had a great time, but I don't think she did, because she left me freezing out there in the cold. The least she could have done was brought me in the house where it wouldn't have been so warm, cold to say goodnight." And after that, a number of months went by, and I didn't call her. Some things happened in my life. Uncle died, and a few other things happened. And I didn't really think she was that excited about me anyhow. But as I learned later, she was sitting there wondering why this jerk didn't call back, because she had a good time too. So finally, at my friend's urging, about 2 months later, I did call her back, and we went out.
Excuse me, what is this lucky lady's name?
Her name is May Ratner-Zoffer now. It was May Ratner at the time. And she was one of twins, and they had to decide which of the twins they would introduce me to. And I like to joke that they kept the other twin in the cellar for the first 6 months, so I wouldn't have any trouble deciding which was which. By the time I got to know my fiance by that time, well, I couldn't see much likeness between the two of them, but they were identical twins. And so the second evening we went out, we had a really great time again, and at the end of the evening we had such a good time that I went through a stop sign on Shady Avenue and was flagged down by a policeman, and he came over and after some extended conversation decided to let me go with a warning, which both of us were rather traumatized by the experience of being sort of hauled over by the police. And so we sat there for about 3 hours, not moving from the spot where the policeman took us over. And at the end of that 3 hours, we decided to get engaged, which is on the second date. And that, I had her in January, the second date was in April, and on July 19th of that year, we were married. That was 34 years ago this year.
On your second date?
On our second date.
That's
1959. And so it was a rather abbreviated courtship, but we had lots of cheering sections from the side and people rooting for us, and as I say, it's now two children and almost 34 years later. And so that's the story of which is totally antithetical to my generally conservative nature. My training as a researcher, which shows that sometimes chemistry is a much more effective or compelling way of making decisions than what would normally be the case. And
would that have been 1960, if you're going to be married 34 years?
We'll be married 34 years in July.
Mm-hmm.
So
that
would be
59.
Yeah, it has to be 59 because my first child was born in 60, and our second child was born in 61. So, and then I was somewhat older than my wife and sort of anxious to get on with family. My wife was just graduating from college that year, and she was undertaking a teaching career. She was a social studies teacher. She began teaching in Dormont High School. And, by October of the following year, I guess about 16 months later, after we got married, my daughter Gail was born. Though I must say I had a very hard time accepting that. In my family, for four generations, there had never been a girl born. Every generation had only boys, and supposedly the male determines the sex. And so I was sure, that being the case, that I would have only boys. My father had only boys. My grandfather had only boys. So when they brought my daughter, when the doctor came in and announced in the waiting room with all these other expecting fathers that Mr. Zoffer was the father of a bouncing baby girl, my retort, which threw the whole room into laughter, was, it can't be mine, it has to be a boy. And then they brought me in and showed me this magnificent young woman, great big eyes looking out at me in a small basket, and that was the birth of my daughter, Gail. But we got right back on track the following year and had the boy, my son Billy. And So that was about 13 months later. And then we decided, having a boy and a girl, we didn't know what else to try for. So we stopped having family at that point, since it didn't seem to be anything new we could discover. And so that's a little bit about at least that part of it.
And where did you live in your early years?
Our first apartment was 1003 North Negley Avenue, which is still there. It's a big apartment complex. I was an East Ender, and my wife was from Squirrel Hill. And so we had a big debate about where we should live, and we ended up living because an apartment was available in Squirrel Hill in East End. We did live there for about a year, and then we bought a house. So my wife went out eventually in Squirrel Hill, which we never left, at 3901 Beachwood Boulevard. And we lived there for about, I suppose, 6 years or something like that. And then as the family began to grow and we found these huge rooms, it looked so huge when we moved in, as the children began to grow and we began running around and accumulating things, we couldn't believe we bought such a small house for such a growing family. We finally moved in 1966 into our present home, where we've been for about 27 years on Hillsborough Avenue. And I guess that's the geographical peregrination, so to talk about.
Could you tell a little bit about the neighborhood and
neighborhood,
your friends? Right.
Mm-hmm. Neighborhood where?
Where you live.
Yeah, currently?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we live on Hillsborough Avenue, about three doors off of Whiteman, and it is a neighborhood of professional people, most of whom have lived in the neighborhood for a long time. It's a reserved neighborhood in the sense that the people are always there if you need to help, but they don't intrude. In fact, when we first moved in, nobody really came around to say hello or welcome us to the neighborhood, which was something we were sort of used to in our previous neighborhoods. And we wondered if we had bad breath or something, but nothing happened. And finally, a neighbor came down maybe 6 months later, stopped in and said that they thought they ought to come down and see us, because the when they moved in some years before, nobody came to see them for a long time. It took them quite a while to understand that that was the nature of the neighborhood. The neighbors didn't intrude. He heaved a sigh of relief that we had done something to offend the neighborhood. And we learned that it was a neighborhood with very fine people who were all very friendly, but who respected your privacy to an incredible extent. As a result, I ran into, at a Christmas party, the people who lived two doors away. And we did not recognize each other. We were introduced, and I said, "Hey, I think that's the name of the people that live two doors from us." And they said, "Yes, we are." So it is that kind of a neighborhood. We don't have block parties. Let's put it that way. And it was a little different than on our house on Beachwood Boulevard, where everybody ran into everybody's house all the time, and it was sort of a much more communal relationship. I'm not critical of it. It's their time when it's nice to have your privacy, but we don't have any problems with people. But I couldn't go too many doors away and still begin to quote the names, I'm afraid.
Could you characterize the neighborhood politically at all, or is that difficult?
Oh, I think, like most neighborhoods in Squirrel Hill, it's probably more democratic and liberal than it is Republican, I would say. The people who are our neighbors are mostly, they're both business people, but they're probably more liberal business people than you would ordinarily find in living business people. I think that they're conservative economically and liberal in a conservative sense, if you understand what I mean. They're not wildly liberal, and they're not major troublemakers in any particular arena. They're very sensible, very committed people, to their communities, most of them very active in other agencies around that affect the community. And I think that it's a relatively safe neighborhood. We've never had a, in our house, we've never had a burglary or anything else until, thank goodness, in 33 years. My wife keeps asking me to put in a burglar alarm system. I keep saying that I think we probably set it off more often than the burglars would. And I really didn't relish bothering our neighbors at 3 o'clock in the morning when the burglar alarm went off. So it's been, I think, a very safe neighborhood. And I wouldn't really much worry about walking around at 12 o'clock at night.
Living in this kind of environment, have you or your children experienced anti-Semitism in the neighborhood or schools?
Well, I can't speak for my children.